our holy grail of Roswell is the memory medal. That's what we're looking for.
Tom Carey, co-author, along with Donald Schmidt, of Witness to Roswell. Now, this is the 75th anniversary edition, unmasking the government's biggest cover-up. George Norrie says, "When I finished Witness to Roswell, I said to myself, case closed, for the very wealth and sheer weight of eyewitness testimony." Again, that's George Norrie, host of Coast to Coast AM. Hundreds of witnesses have provided, in some cases, firsthand accounts of what went on. Tom Carey.
We feel that we have basically nailed the case as to what happened from the time the ship, they say crashed, but it actually exploded in the air, from that time to when it was discovered the next day, all the way to when it was the wreckage and the bodies were shipped to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, to where they might be today. So we have witnesses all along that timeline.
Now, Tom Carey has a master's degree in anthropology. He's also a U.S. Air Force veteran. He held top secret clearance. This current version of the book adds more testimony. The timing on this, we both watched the government hearings on UFOs, so it was nice to compare notes with Tom. This isn't the first time the government has actually had a hearing to address the issue of UFOs, but it's been a long time coming for the second one.
54 years, to be exact. It was 1968. 54 years for the last government. It was by the House of Representatives under the auspices of Gerald Ford, who was a representative at that time. They held one day, just like today, one day hearings. Only those hearings back in 1968 were based upon a series of sightings they had in Representative Ford's district in Ann Arbor and Dexter, Michigan. There were these sightings that, and this is where the famous swamp gas term came to be used. And so Blue Book sent Alan Hynek to investigate these sightings in Ann Arbor, Michigan. A lot of people had seen them, and the sightings were in a swampy area. And Hynek gets off the plane, and he hasn't even been to the site yet. He hasn't interviewed anybody. He gets off the plane, and he's rushed by reporters. Professor Hynek, he was an astronomer at Northwestern University. He was the Project Blue Book's scientific consultant at the time. So he gets off the plane, and they rush him. Professor, what do you think it could be? And he says, "Oh well, I understand that it's these sightings. Some of them took place in a swampy area, and there's this phenomenon known as swamp gas." And he never got to finish the sentence. They rushed off to the telephone to report that the professor said the sightings were swamp gas, and he never lived it down. The country never accepted the explanation, and that's when the Air Force turned over the project to the University of Colorado. This is 1966. They turned the UFO Project Blue Book. They said, "You here, University of Colorado, you take this, investigate it, and give us what your opinion is of UFOs." Well, it took the University of Colorado, the famous Condon Committee, 3 years, and they came back with the report that UFOs are a number of things, some of which are unexplainable, but we don't see that they're a threat to national security, and we don't see that anything of a scientific value can be gained by studying them. And that's all the Air Force wanted to hear. So in 1969, they closed Project Blue Book, and but that didn't stop UFO sightings. The UFOs didn't go back to, they didn't back it up and go back to wherever they came from. So we have what we have today. 54 years later, another House of Representatives, the Intelligence Committee hearing. It was not based on cases, but although a case did spurn this, it was the 2004 USS Nimitz aircraft carrier case where they spotted these so-called Tic Tacs. And everybody's seen the video on television. They've played it thousands of times. It was put out by a fellow who used to head up a secret government investigation of UFOs from 2007 to 2012 called the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Project. The Advanced Aerospace Identification Project. His name is Luis Elizondo. He's been on television many times, and he was dissatisfied with the way this committee was going from 2007 to 2012. It cost $22 million. It was funded. And he was upset with the way it was going. They weren't taking it serious. So he took a couple of videos with him, and he got them on television. And everybody in the world, I think, has seen these. And the Department of Defense was forced to say whether they were real or not. And everybody could see they were real. They were from the Navy. They were these gun camera photo videos of this strange craft that was, you know, spotted, and they had it on their gun cameras. And so they said, yes, the Department of Defense said, yes, these are legitimate videos. So this was a watershed moment for the subject of UFOs, which had up until that point been basically ridiculed in the major media. There are a lot of shows on cable and the alternate press, but the mainstream media, they don't like UFOs. It's a paranormal type subject. They don't like the paranormal. But with the Defense Department okaying this as a real, these videos are real, we don't know what they are, and that's all we have to say. So that's what sort of spawned this committee finally, because it was a government mandate to have the intelligence committees tell us what they know about UFOs. Now, today's hearing was a total waste of time, because as the general public, they want to know what these things are, because they've been being seen for 75 years. Of course, my specialty is I spent 31 years on Roswell by itself and have co-authored 10 or 11 books on the subject. I've lost count. Today's hearing was all about, and Wendy, I knew they were going to do this. It wasn't a surprise to me, but it was all about process and methodology and how they're going to collect data and all that administrative stuff. The public wants to hear what are those things are and where do they come from? Why are they here? None of that. None of that took place. And this was the unclassified hearing. There is a classified hearing, which the public won't hear. Mm-hmm. So much for transparency. Mm-hmm. And so it was all about that. And the other thing is that this committee, this UAP task force, I don't know if it's a senatorial committee it's a Department of Defense operation study UFOs. And the thing is, they're not going back 75 years. Their baseline begins in 2004. So they're not going to analyze anything before that. And it also, it can't be like civilians reporting cases. Yeah. It has to come through the government. And in this case, the government entity that these cases are coming through is the U.S. Navy. Now, you're too young to remember, but since 1947, when the modern age of UFOs started, it's 75 years ago. Those cases between 1947 and 2004 are not going to be in this study. Now, this is where all of the best cases are. You know, you got Roswell, you got you know, a lot of cases that people know, they want to know what it was, but those cases are not going to be studied. It's 2004, beginning with the Nimitz case, coming forward. And it's going to be data driven, meaning they're going to have these algorithms and all that sort of stuff. And if a case is reported by testimony, well, that's not going to be. They want things that they can measure that are data points, like radar and the gun cameras from the Navy fighters, things like that, that they can put little pieces of data in this big super duper algorithm of theirs to try to determine trends and things like that. Now, between 1975 and the present, 95% of the UFO cases were handled by the Air Force. The Air Force is not part of this committee. I mean, they don't contribute to all the cases that they had are not going to be part of this analysis, with this super duper data collection process. All the Air Force is not—they're not in this. It's just a Navy show. So they've circumscribed the things that they're going to cover. And today's hearing was a total waste of time. I watched it all, and I said, "Oh my goodness! I see what they're doing here. It's another cover up, Wendy. It's another cover up. You know, you have the unclassified piece, and then you have the classified piece. And a couple questions today. There were only a very few questions today that were substantive. And all of those substantive questions were answered by, well, we can't discuss that here. We'll discuss that in closed session. So it was just underwhelming is the term I'm looking for.
Let me see if you agree with me. I watched it too. And what I got, fortunately, I was able to kind of tune in at the right time. There was about an hour into it after the introductions and explanations. They found no UAP collisions, 11 near misses, no communication from the objects that they saw or to the objects. And they considered that because it was they think that they are unmanned, so there was no point in trying to connect or communicate. Wreckage, they say the UAP task force has nothing that is considered ET.
The project doesn't have anything, but the government has things.
Well, they sidestepped that. And then with the question you mentioned earlier about referring to closed session, someone asked about the USO, the underwater UAP.
Yes, yes.
And they said we'll deal with that in the closed session. So it was a very an attempt to say we're talking about that. The one thing I saw is it takes the stigma away because now there are reports.
Yes. So. Exactly. Absolutely. And it was those videos that Luis Elizondo put out that started it. And the fact now that the government appears, I underline the word appears, to be taking it seriously, has taken it out of the realm of ridicule and laughter. And it has given it a legitimacy that it has never had before.
I want to get now to the book, Witness to Roswell. This is a 75th anniversary edition, and you and Donald Schmidt have done a tremendous job. I mean, you've got the intro from
Edgar Mitchell.
Yes, I'm sorry. And then the outro from George Norrie saying this is the true thing. And Edgar Mitchell had people coming up because he was from New Mexico, very, close
yes,
by.
Yes, he was from Artesia.
And so he didn't know about it then because he was in high school and didn't register on his radar. But coming back after having been a space person.
He went to the moon, yes.
Yeah, all of a sudden they wanted to tell him. And these are people that are in the area, the farmers, the community people who felt like he would respect them and value their information.
Exactly, yes.
The due diligence, you guys have been on this case. The people you have been able to talk to, Jesse Marcel Jr., some of the other people from that community who didn't want to talk, and you were able to make some inroads through the museum there in Roswell. Where are we now?
As far as the Roswell case, Wendy, where the gumshoe investigation like we have been doing for over 30 years, where we travel the country interviewing people.
Hundreds.
Yeah, hundreds, yes, hundreds of them. That is over. Certainly all of the people involved that we knew of are all dead. There's none alive that we are aware of. There may be some alive that, you know, we weren't able to locate or even look for, still alive, but we are unaware of who they might be. So the proactive phase of the case is over, because as far as we know, everyone is dead, and we are not getting leads like we did, say, in the, you know, 30 years ago.
You were able to basically follow the trail.
Yes. Well, what we did is that each of us has a copy. This is not an original, but a photocopy of the 1947 Roswell Air Base yearbook that has 3,000 names and pictures of everybody on the base, but it actually has only about 50% of the people who were on the base at that time, but it's still like 3,000 people. So we used that as a investigative tool, looking for names that were idiosyncratic. And by that, I mean where names other than Smith or Jones or Williams or Mr. Brown, you know, names that we might have an idea or a chance of locating. So that's what we did. And those would lead to other names. And we have interviewed over 600 first and secondhand witnesses on the case. And those are, you know, like I said, we've done somewhere between 10 and 12 books. I'd have to actually count them to be positive.
You were talking to some of these people, and it wasn't that they were there firsthand, but some of it was the stuff that they overheard from other, from relatives or
yes,
from neighbors?
Yeah, first and secondhand. And if the secondhand, secondhand witness is good, if it corroborates a firsthand witness, they were an invaluable resource. And we feel that we have basically nailed the case as to what happened from the time the ship, they say crashed, but it actually exploded in the air, from that time to when it was discovered the next day, all the way to when it was the wreckage and the bodies were shipped to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, to where they might be today. So we have witnesses all along that timeline. And the witnesses that we've been getting most recently, they've just basically reinforced the timeline that we had already put together. We believe we've solved that. The only thing we're missing, Wendy, is an actual incontrovertible physical piece of evidence, like a piece of art. Our holy grail of Roswell is the memory medal. That's what we're looking for, a piece of memory medal, because you can get a piece of metal, you know, that looks like a piece of aluminum and say, oh, that's from the spaceship. Well, no, you have to send that out and have it analyzed, and you never hear from it again. So, but the memory medal, you can hold in your hand, you can wad it up, have a TV camera on live, and then you can open your hand and watch it unfurl itself and just float there in midair, just floating there. We don't have anything like that. So with a demonstration like that, you don't have to send it out, although at some point we would. But that would be an immediate demonstration of the so-called memory medal. A lot of it was among the wreckage that was found, and so that's what we're looking for.
Well, and that's what Jesse Marcel Jr. saw. That was his father was on the scene at the site. Jesse Marcel Jr. said that he showed him that piece of metal.
Yes. Yes, Jesse Sr. was the major. He was a major, and he was the base intelligence officer at the air base in Roswell, which was 7 miles south of the town. He was the first military person to the crash site. And we say crash site, but it's where the thing exploded in the air and all that pieces of wreckage fell to the ground in a sheep pasture of a ranch that was run by a fellow by the name of Mac Brazel. And Marcel was the first military person there, along with Sheridan Cabot, who was a counterintelligence officer. Marcel was the intelligence officer. And according to Jesse Jr., his father, when he came home that night, he was on his way back to the base from the crash site with a car full of wreckage. And he stopped home because he wanted to show his wife and his son, Jesse Jr., who was 11 at the time, what this stuff was. And according to Jesse Jr., he said his father believed that it was from a, by the, even when he got home at 2 a.m. in that morning, he said his father believed it was from a crashed spaceship or a flying saucer, as they called them back then. He was convinced of it because he was familiar with everything that was, you know, airplanes and balloons and all that. He was familiar with all that stuff. And Jesse Jr., who said his father believed then, even before he got it to the base, that it was from a flying saucer. So amongst the wreckage was this little, we call it an I-beam. That's like if you're cutting a layer cake and you look at it sideways. Well, this little beam, which was about 18 inches long, if you cut it sideways, it looked like the letter I, the capital letter I. And almost like if you looked at a railroad track sideways, lengthwise, it looks like a I. But along the inner collar of this I beam were symbols, strange markings in purple. And he didn't recognize any of them. They just thought, well, they're hieroglyphics or something. But Jesse Jr. Always remembered those. And he is our chief. He died in 2013, I believe it was. Mm-hmm. And he was our chief informer as to these symbols. Others had said, yes, there were symbols on the other wreckage, but Jesse could actually, under hypnosis, almost draw pictures of what the symbols looked like. And I don't know if you've ever met Jesse Jr.,
no.
But he was, a lieutenant colonel. He had he was a medical doctor, and in his 70s, he was deployed to Iraq twice. And he was a helicopter pilot, and just the nicest person you'd ever want to meet. And no BSing from him. He was a straight shooter. And unfortunately, he's gone now.
I talked with Dr. Richard O'Connor. He's the director for the Jesse Marcel Library, and he was friends with Jesse Marcel Jr. So I was tracking the story, but wasn't, quick enough to be able to interview Jesse Marcel Jr.
Fortunately, I met him just a few months before he died, because he came down to the UFO Museum in Roswell that year in 2013. And I'm a speaker there every year. And so the last thing I remember is that we were in they have a parade on the 4th of July.
Uh-huh.
And he and I shared in the back of a pickup truck. We shared sitting on the same bale of hay and in this parade. And, never thinking that he was just a few months away from passing away, because he looked fine,
Mm-hmm.
And according to his wife, I think he passed away while he was reading a UFO book. Not ours, I don't think, but he was reading a UFO book when he passed away. But just a great guy.
With all of this stuff that happened, and then our government trying to basically shutter it, make sure nobody talked about it, because they harassed people who were on site. The farmer who owned the land, he was saying he wished he had just buried the thing and never, ever had anything to do with it.
Yes, this is one reason that we believe that this task force is limiting the scope of their analysis or their investigation, let's say, back to 2004, is because they don't want to go back to have to answer questions about what they did at Roswell.
Yeah.
And what they did at Roswell was to threaten civilians. Now, the military, they told the military people, because that, you know, everybody on the base had heard this, you know, what was going on. And so they said to the military people, okay, what they would do is they would gather them, all the enlisted people and all the non-commissioned officers, they'd gather them in a hangar and say, okay, you fellas, whatever you think you're hearing here, we don't want you to talk about it. And if you want to learn any more about it, you can learn about it in Leavenworth. Now, Leavenworth is a federal prison in Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how they handled the military people on the basis. They threatened them with imprisonment. And the media, they put out the weather balloon story. First, they put out the story that it was that they captured a flying saucer. Well, they didn't capture it. The thing blew up in the air, and the wreckage was brought to the base. And so they put out a headline: Roswell Army Airfield is in possession of a downed flying saucer. And it went out once it got on the Associated Press wire and the United Press wire, went around the world, and boy, it just caught the fancy of everybody. Within hours, they changed their story because the word got to Washington and they panicked. They said, "Oh my goodness, we didn't want this to go around. This can't happen.
It's too hot.
This can't happen." So they got in touch with the 8th Air Force Command at Fort Worth, which was the parent of the 509th Bomb Group in Roswell. They said, get this story killed in the press. Get the press off of our backs. Get this story killed. So that's when they came up, within hours of the flying saucer headline, they came up with the weather balloon story. And the press was only too happy to drop it.
Yeah.
So the press dropped the story because they didn't like those stories. They still don't. They still don't. So that leaves the civilians, Wendy, who were still the civilians who were in the know. Some of them got to the crash site, and they talked, and the others talked. And according to one witness, the story went around town in Roswell in 20 minutes. She said that everybody became aware in town of this story, and there was talk of little people.
Yeah.
That's what they called the aliens.
Yeah.
They called them little people. And there's talk of little people that were on this ill-fated spaceship.
Well, that they deal with that. It's page 135. This is the overheard phone call when they asked for the little caskets.
Yes, exactly. Little people and the children-sized caskets that were ordered from the Ballard Funeral Home. And so what they did to those people was to threaten them. First, they threatened them with putting them in an insane asylum. We got that from Mac Brazel. They threatened him with putting him in an insane asylum. And who else? They did somebody else with us. Frank Joyce, the radio announcer at KGFL, who was putting out the story because they got the press release. So he was reading the press release. And they threatened Frank Joyce. And they actually did put him in an insane asylum in Texas, put him on ice for a year to keep him quiet. And he never did go back to Roswell after that, but he's buried in Roswell, but he went to Albuquerque instead. So first they threatened them with incarceration in a insane asylum.
Extreme measures in this case to keep people from talking about it and shut the story down. Witness to Roswell, 75th Anniversary Edition. We'll be back with more with Tom Carey, Wendy's Coffee House. Tom Carey, co-author of the book Witness to Roswell, the 75th Anniversary Edition, Unmasking the Government's Biggest Cover-Up. These were extreme measures to shut this story up and keep people from talking about it, period.
Then they started threatening people with their lives. If you talk about this, we're not only going to kill you, we're going to kill your whole family. And they did that even with the sheriff of Chavez County, which seat is in Roswell. The sheriff helped out the fellows over at the base by fielding phone calls about, that came in around the world. Mm-hmm. Because the people on the base who were most involved, the old saying, getting out of Dodge, we got out of Dodge. Well, the base commander, quote unquote, went on leave. The base public information officer went home to lay low, and they said to phone calls coming in, transfer them to the sheriff. And so they would call the sheriff, and he would tell them, well, I can't tell you anything. I'm just helping out the boys at the base, and there's nothing I can tell you. So it was a circular situation where the press couldn't get anything more. The other thing was a number of the witnesses at the crash site were Mexican ranchers and ranch hands, because they did a lot of ranching for ranch owners and what have you. And the sheriff of Roswell was fluent in Spanish, George Wilcox. He was fluent in Spanish. So they used Wilcox to deliver the death threats to the Mexican community, who were either at the crash site or who had heard about the bodies. So he would go around and deliver the death threats to them. You want to talk? We're going to kill you. And so one day after all this had died down, here comes the military or the Air Force to the sheriff's office. And they thought, oh, boy, they're coming here to give me an award or something because I did so well for them. Well, what they did is they put him in a hammer lock behind his back, shoved him up against the wall and said, if you're going to talk about this, we're going to kill you. We're going to kill your wife and we're going to kill your children. And so that's that. And Wilcox never ran for sheriff again. And according to his family, the Roswell incident destroyed him.
It sounded like it did that for a lot of people who were there. You get to that and the deathbed confessions. I didn't see the white light, but I did see the aliens at Wilford Hall.
Wilford Hall is the hospital at Lackland Air Force Base. I was in there myself for one night. When you enlist in the Air Force or when you go into the Air Force, you go to Lackland Air Force Base to be mustered in. And the hospital there is Wilford Hall. And so I'm in basic training at Lackland, and I got walking pneumonia. And they said, get over to the hospital. So I spent a night at Wilford Hall, not knowing that, you know, what the history of Wilford Hall was. But this one fellow, I forget his last name, but he was in the Air Force. He was in intelligence, and he was ordered to go to Wilford Hall at Lackland Air Force Base to observe an autopsy of sorts. This fellow was sent to Wilford Hall to observe something in the hospital. And so he's walking down the corridor, one of the corridors, and the door is open. And he looks, and inside he can see a small child-sized body. He thought, well, that's got to be a child, but it had this very large head and just a little slit for a mouth, and then two eyes with no eyelids. And he says, oh my God, what is that? And so years later, he had a heart attack, and he thought he was going to pass away And apparently he did get close or something, because when he woke up from whatever operation he was having, his son said, "Dad, Dad, are you okay? And did you see the bright light?" Because he either got close to death or he was temporarily, he expired and they brought him back. So his son said, "Did you see the bright light?" And he said, "No, I didn't see the bright light, but I saw the aliens at Wilford Hall." Mm-hmm. And that's the gist of that story. And so we put that in the book. I can't remember the gentleman's name.
That's chapter 23, though, and that is an excellent chapter because it has all these deathbed confessions.
Deathbeds, yes. We have a lot of deathbeds. Edwin Easley was one of the first. He was actually one of the first key, if I had to list key witnesses, he would be near the top. He was the base provost marshal, which he was the top guy in the MPs, the military police. And of course they guarded the crash sites, right? When they found the wreckage, he was in charge of guarding all the crash sites. And then there were three of them, three crash sites, flying saucer. But so Easley was interviewed early on in the our investigation of the Roswell incident back in 1990-91 thereabouts, and Kevin Randall was interviewing him, and to every question that Kevin asked him, Easley would say, "Well, I can't answer because I'm sworn to secrecy." "Well, what about this? I'm sworn to secrecy." "What about that? I'm sworn to secrecy. I'm sorry." Well, sort of, I guess Kevin got, that was about it. And so he just says, "Well, can you tell me one thing, Colonel Easley? Are we going in the right direction?" And Easley says, "Well, what direction do you mean?" And he says, and Kevin says, "Well, we think it was a flying saucer that crashed. UFO. And there's a long pause, and Easley says, "Well, let me say this, you're not going in the wrong direction." So that was a key statement at a point early in the case to verify that the road that led to a crashed flying saucer was the correct one from a higher up at the base. Mm-hmm. Now, a couple years later, Easley is on his deathbed at Parkland Memorial Hospital in Dallas. That's where President Kennedy was taken after he was, when he was shot. He's in the Parkland Memorial Hospital in Dallas. He's on his deathbed, but he's still speaking. He's still conversant. And he has his two daughters and a granddaughter there. And so the granddaughter brought a book that Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt had written. It was their first book called UFO Crash at Roswell. It was the second ever book written about Roswell. The first one was the 1980 book, The Roswell Incident, by William Moore and Charles Berlitz. Now, this is 1992, 3, 4, somewhere in there. And Randall and Schmidt had written in 1991, UFO Crash at Roswell, which sort of reopened the case. It reopened the case. And so she holds this book up in front of Colonel, her grandfather, Edwin Easley. "What about this, Granddad? What about this?" So Easley looks at it and he just says, "Oh, the creatures." That was his only comment. Then he apologized to his family for not telling them sooner about this, because he had kept it secret all that time because he had promised President Truman through Truman's emissary that he would not speak about the case. So he's in our deathbed chapter as well.
There's another one here. He's one of the Native Americans. I have to look at the full-blooded Comanche Indian. And he was on his deathbed in 1982. According to
that would be Myers Wani. Mm-hmm. That's Myers Wani, full Comanche. He was a bomber pilot in World War II. He was a security captain after the war. He was in security. I forget at which base. A base in Denver, Colorado. They brought him down to Roswell to guard over there was a flight of bodies on July the 9th, 1947. There was a flight of bodies from, it was supposed to go to ultimately Wright-Patterson, but it stopped over at Carswell Air Force Base. Back then it was known as Fort Worth Army Airfield in Texas, with this box of it was a big box, about 16 feet long, 5 feet wide by 4 feet high, big wooden box that carried two or three cadavers, alien cadavers. And it flew on July 9, and they put it in the bomb bay at a B-29, which was the aircraft of choice back then at Roswell. So they put it in the bomb bay of a B-29 known as the Straight Flush. And Myers-Wani was a captain. He was like an MP captain that oversaw. He was in the bomb bay with armed guards, and they flew at low altitude, like 6,000 feet, over to Fort Worth and dropped the box off. Now, the B-29 cruises usually at 29,000 feet. They flew at 6,000 because the plane was not pressurized at that point, and they didn't want to. They thought it might affect the biological entities that were on the flight. So, on his deathbed, Wani, he's on his deathbed, and he blurts out to his family, "Don't you believe what you read in the papers?" I think this is about 1982, somewhere in that range. Mm-hmm. "Don't you believe whatever you read about Roswell in the newspapers, because it really happened. It really happened." And, you're on your deathbed and you would say something like that. Deathbed statements are usually given extra weight in courts of law because it suggests, that a person is trying to get something off, clear something, get off something off their chest, mm-hmm. To make it right.
Yeah, clear the
so
conscience.
He told his family. Now, this was like 2 years after the Roswell book came out, the Roswell incident. And he says, "Whatever you read in the newspapers about the Roswell incident, don't you believe it, because it really happened." And so he's in our chapter. We have a photograph of him. And that was Myers-Wani.
I want to do this is something I think is the smoking gun. And there's a reason, I'm sure. But you ran into a brick wall with Robert Bigelow.
Well, Robert, Robert Bigelow, being a high billionaire, he's not going to answer the phone.
No.
Himself.
No.
So, we never did get to him personally, but we have a fellow. His name is Anthony Bergaglia, lives in Florida, who is a terrific investigator. I mean, he doesn't take no for an answer, and he doesn't give up. If somebody hangs up the phone on him, he calls them right back.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he tried to get to Bigelow, but he ultimately got to Bigelow Corporation's lawyer. And so he started questioning Bigelow's lawyer. I don't remember what his name was. And this is not too long ago. We believe that the Roswell wreckage is at Bigelow Aerospace in Nevada. That's where we believe it. That's where even though the task force today did not say anything about it, we got it, and this is, you can take this to the bank. We got it from the Defense Intelligence Agency that the UAP wreckage, that's the UFO wreckage, is at Bigelow Aerospace in Nevada. And so Regalia gets to the lawyer for Bigelow Aerospace and starts questioning him. You know, you try to start out pleasant and all that, but when he started asking about UAP or UFO wreckage, the tone of the lawyer changed, and he says, I'm not going to talk about this, and he hung up.
Mm-hmm.
So that's as close as we got to Bigelow. It was actually Tony Regalia, our intrepid, he's an independent investigator, but he's very close to us.
Wernher von Braun, he's a person I've heard mentioned through the years as having significant interest and belief that this isn't something that's unusual, it isn't impossible, it's a reality. Could you give us some background on him?
Yes, Wernher von Braun was a German rocket scientist. He was the one responsible for designing the V-2 rockets during World War II. For Germany. And when the war was over, the race was on between us and the Russians to get him.
Yeah.
And we finally got to him first in Austria, where he was hiding out with other rocket scientists. So we got his whole crew of rocket scientists. We brought them over to the United States in 1945 under Operation Paperclip, a secret CIA operation, and they were brought to Fort Bliss in Texas. Well, he became the father of the American space program. His interest was in space. The Germans used him to build rockets for military, or else they would have done it. Or else, you know, they said, well, you don't do this, we're going to, you know, you're history.
Right.
And he was forced to do that. But he became the father of the American space program, designing the Saturn V booster and putting the first satellite in orbit in 1958, the Explorer. And that's the thing. But he made two public statements about UFOs. Only two public statements. They both said, UFOs are real. They possess powers far beyond our state of knowledge. They are more powerful than we ever expected, and we don't know what their intentions are. And he says, but beyond that, I can tell you no more. So he said that twice publicly. So,
well, it seems like there's been a major effort to keep whatever significant information that we have about UFOs and downed craft away from public view. And in that session, I watched it and reviewed some of it today for the hearing on the government investigation of UFOs. There was a little caveat to what they're putting out. And the language was that if we believe it to be a military issue, we don't want to basically show our hand and say how we're determining what these UFOs do or where they're coming from, because they consider that a threat and that's proprietary information. So it will not, in my interpretation, understanding, that means it's not going to be public. They're still going to withhold information, bottom line.
You got that exactly right. You got that exactly right. They're approaching this whole problem of phenomenon of UFOs from a national security perspective. So, and the general citizens, we're not interested in that. We want to know what they are, where they came from, and why they might be here. We're not interested in, we don't want the Chinese to know about this. We don't want to let them know we have anything. So what you just said is exactly right. So if you do come across something, and they do have it. That's going to be their excuse for not making it public.
If this were a planetary concern, in terms of a global threat, which if they're here and they have technology beyond our ability to fathom, we aren't the only ones that are at risk the entire planet is at risk. So it doesn't make sense to me to withhold that type of information if it's considered threatening to the human population. So to me, that's counterintuitive, but I just thought that's a way of saying, okay, we told you everything we can, and now from now on, you'll have to understand we're keeping it private because it's a military issue.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Yeah, so, but that was buried. That was buried deep within all the other stuff. And I thought, oh, that was brilliant. Because it was just right there, subtle, and yeah, okay. That to me defined it.
Yeah, if they get a good case, you're not going to hear about it. You're not going to hear about it. Because it will be in closed session, if there, and the public will never hear about it.
And part of it, I do understand, because if the technology required to track this type of stuff, these phenomena, it has to be incredibly advanced. And so then you're giving away your tools. So
does a bear conduct business in the woods?
Yeah. So, but we've already heard that this stuff is beyond our ability to do anything, replicate.
And they've known this from 1947.
Yes. Yeah. It was like, wake up. Now, back to that mystery metal. Could you address that? Because this is the stuff I think is fascinating. How are we even close?
Well, like I said, what happened was that the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, the Foreign Technology Division, they sent some of memory metal to Battelle Memorial Institute in 1948. This is like right after all this stuff came in from Roswell. They tasked the Battelle Memorial Institute in Columbus, Ohio, just down the road from Wright-Patterson, to try to back engineer that memory metal, because it had these properties that you couldn't destroy it. But it was self-healing. It was morphing metal. It could change shape. And so they just wanted to know, what is this made of? So Battelle, and we get this from someone who worked on it at Battelle.
Okay.
They didn't tell them where they got it. They just said, okay, see what you can do. See if you can find out what makes this metal tick, and go to it. And so Battelle, they didn't like their name in the same paragraph as the term flying saucer or UFO. They just did not want their name associated with that. So they worked on it, but they would try. And from one of the base commanders in the mid-1960s, we got it from him that his understanding was that the crash, the metal was made of titanium and some other metal, but he didn't know what the other one was. So what they were doing is they were trying to meld titanium with this metal or that metal, and they came up with the nickel. Titanium and nickel, which seemed to be the best fit to try to mimic the features of this memory metal. So that's where you get the term nitinol, NI stands for nickel, TI stands for titanium, and the NOL stands for Naval Ordnance Lab in Maryland. Mm. Now, the way that came in is that, like I said, Battelle did not want to be associated with UFOs. So they farmed out, they laundered it through the Naval Ordnance Lab. Mm-hmm. And they came out with, in 1962, they made the announcement that they had developed something called nitinol. But it was really developed at Battelle from the Roswell wreckage, and it was announced at the Naval Ordnance Lab because neither one, Battelle or Wright-Patterson, they didn't want to know, they didn't want the people to know that it came from the Roswell wreckage. So that's how that's the closest we came to mimicking or back engineering this memory metal. And you can buy it by the sheet, you can buy it by the roll, you can buy it by the coil. Just put it in your web browser and you'll see what uses it has been used for. It's also used in the space program. So that's the story on Nitinol. And as far as Bigelow Aerospace, Tony Bregaglia got the Defense Intelligence Agency. In 2017, the New York Times broke the story that the government was indeed investigating UFOs all these years under this ATIP program, Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. And once Tony saw that, he put together a FOIA request, a Freedom of Information Act request, for where is the UFO wreckage being stored and what the programs are you using to try to exploit it. And for 3 years, he didn't hear anything. So Tony has access to lawyers, and he says, okay, I'm going to sue you if I don't hear from you in 2 weeks to respond to my FOIA request of 3 years ago. Well, guess what? He within 2 weeks, he got a response. And in a nutshell, the Defense Intelligence Agency said that the UAP, and Tony never used the term UAP, yeah. He used the term UFO. Mm-hmm. And the response back was that the UAP material crash wreckage is at Bigelow Aerospace, just north of Nevada, Las Vegas, Nevada. And here are the programs they're working on with this metal. And so help me, Wendy, it's all has to do with trying to shrink the speed of light, messing around with time, and those sorts of things. Because we have not had big discussions on where they came from or why they're here and all that sort of stuff. But at one point, I'm thinking to myself, well, how did it get here from somewhere else in the universe to Earth? Because the space is space differentials are so great, so it has to be something that they shrunk space or they shrunk time, something like that. And that's what these programs that they're doing at Bigelow Aerospace. So it leads you to believe that they were time travelers. They were time travelers.
You see, some of that's fascinating. So, I mean, when you talk or read some of the experiencers' stories and see some of the diagrams, the drawings that show a UFO coming through an open, like a cloud, an opening in a cloud, a portal, and you see them materialize or dematerialize in front of
yes,
you.
Yes, yes.
Those things suggest that this isn't a ship like we are considering, nuts and bolts, and it's going to go from here to Mars, and it takes so many hours.
Right.
This is a dimension shift, and so that's a whole different reality that we have to progress to.
It's in our book, Wendy, that there were two fellows. One was a physicist, a doctoral, one of the paperclip Germans. He was a physicist, second in command behind Wernher von Braun. He worked for years for the U.S. Air Force in the rocket program, their guided missile program. He was involved in Roswell, and I interviewed his two sons. The one son, before I hung up, he told me, he says, well, what happened at Roswell wasn't extraterrestrial. It was extra dimensional. Now, where would he get that from? He got it from his father, who worked on the Roswell case and was a trained rocket scientist. And he worked for the Air Force in their UFO program, but he knew about Roswell. And he said it was extra dimensional. Now, there was one other fella was in Wernher von Braun's crew, and this fella was in the Navy. He was the Navy's go-to guy when it became to flying saucers. He was a naval commander named George Hoover, and he was the so-called father of our space satellite technology. So he's a it's not Uncle Harry down the street talking. It's the father of our space satellite technology, and he was involved in Roswell. And he said that the Roswell crash involved the crash of the vehicle and the beings. It was a crash from somewhere else, and by somewhere else, he meant it wasn't extraterrestrial, it was extratemporal, meaning that they were time travelers. And he even went so far as to say they could be us from a future Earth. And that's from a guy that was involved in all of that stuff. And again, this is not Aunt Louisa or Uncle Harry saying this. These are people who were there and know and knew.
What are we not asking about this? Because we need to evolve to be able to question more about this reality instead of just looking for pieces of metal.
Certainly the Congress people today, they are not asking about it.
No. They haven't watched enough sci-fi.
Yes.
Anyway, I think Witness to Roswell, the 75th anniversary edition, brings everybody up to speed on the tremendous amounts of legwork it takes to get into the depths, the details, the facts, the truth, into something that the government tries to cover up intentionally. And finally, people who've witnessed this or have these experiences don't feel like they're going to automatically be shunned when they say, I saw a UFO, or I have been contacted, connected. I think that's the next step, is dealing with the witnesses.
Yes, this task force, they will never, ever answer any questions about Roswell, because if they did admit, okay, we do have this stuff, that means that they've been lying to us for 75 years, and they don't want to answer questions about the civil rights violations that they perpetrated upon the citizens of Roswell back then. So they will never talk about Roswell, even though Roswell is the most thoroughly investigated UFO case of all time. It took us over 30 years because there were so many witnesses to it. And
the
case was so variegated.
That's the beauty of it. That many witnesses. And it's like the Ariel phenomenon that the movie has just come out finally in Ruwa, Zimbabwe. There were so many witnesses, they couldn't make it go away.
And Zimbabwe is a great case. Zimbabwe is a great case, very similar to the Westall case in Australia, which are, both of them are in my top five.
Okay, what are the others of your top five?
Rendlesham and, what's the other one? Say Roswell, Rendlesham, Zimbabwe, Phoenix Lights.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's some fantastic ones in South America, too. There's just, at this point...
Yeah, Vargina. Yeah,
yes.
Vargina, yeah.
There's so much content available with the internet. People can do more research and find out facts as opposed to, you know, the stories that are being told that dismiss all of this. It's finally nice to hear that these stories are okay to talk about. You know, you've done so much work. You are adding to the equation. So I appreciate all of the work that you've done, and that you were, you know, like a dog with a bone, continuing to stick with the story for 30 some years, 40 years.
Yes, I thought I'd be done with it when I took my I took my first trip to Roswell in 1993, and I figured, well, that's it.
Time flies.
Oh my goodness! Yes, I thought, well, that's the end of that. Well, next case.
Well, and that's what you address in the book. This is the case. This is the case.
Yes. Yes.
Anything you want to
this
add?
This is the only case.
Yeah,
yes.
Before we sign off, would you like to add anything else?
Like I said, the gumshoe, the proactive phase is over. We really have gotten the case nailed. The only thing we're missing is a piece of physical evidence, which is the fallback position, as you know, from your scientists. Oh, yes, yes, yes. We believe there's life, other life in the universe, but no, we don't think that it has come here. Show me a piece of evidence. And what they mean is physical piece of evidence, because testimony itself is evidence in courts of law if it is credible. And we have had lawyers tell us that if we ever took this case to court against, like, the Air Force or the U.S. government, we would win hands down, because they don't have any evidence for their position that this so-called Project Mogul or these dime store mannequins falling from the sky. They have no case. We would win hands down.
Okay, your website.
Our website that we've had since 2007 has been co-opted by the Chinese, believe it or not, and we have to rebuild it. But our contact information is in the book, my website address and my email address. You can contact even by telephone, and you can also contact us through the UFO Museum in Roswell. But our website that we had up since 2007, which is like 15 years, the Chinese have somehow they've taken it over.
So to connect with you, basically the museum in Roswell is a good place to start too, and then the contact information in the book, Amazon.
Yes, and we both have Facebook pages as well.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. I appreciate your time. And in the book, there's also a very good description of the aliens they found. So we'll leave something else for people to look up and find more information on in the book. We're not going to give that secret away here.
By the way, where are you?
I'm in Kansas City.
The 509th bomb group was at Roswell in 1947, that was the group that ended World War II. By dropping the atomic bombs on Japan. It has relocated to a city called Knob Noster, Missouri. I don't know if you've ever heard of that.
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, it's Whiteman Air Force Base at Knob Noster, Missouri, is where the 509th is today. And their mission is the same as it was back in 1947. It's to drop nuclear bombs on a potential enemy.
Wow.
So it's still in existence.
Let's hope we evolve beyond that.
Yes, yes.
Hey, Tom, thank you.
My pleasure. Have a great day.
The links are in the description for the show. And I have a website. I also have a book, Talking to Nightlights. That's Talking to Nightlights 2 and available on Amazon. And then the website, talkingtonightlights.com. That's where I put the show notes for Wendy's Coffee House, and Conscious Living. Time and again, I return to the story of John Foster. He had massive amounts of notes relating to the multiple contacts he had over four decades and the various types of ETs, aliens, transdimensionals, we really don't know for sure, that he had contact with. They don't all look like us. They don't all look like Grace. They are unique. And until we learn to accept some of these things as real experiences, we're going to be stuck spinning our wheels. John Foster UFOs. Right now, he has a blog available. He also has four books. The blog may not be here in perpetuity, but the four books are available on Amazon. I asked Tom what was next after this, you know, the completion of the Roswell story, and he has something that involves the supernatural. So, of course, we're going to be talking again. Hopefully you'll check back in when we do. Thanks for listening. I'm Wendy. This is Wendy's Coffee House. Stay curious.